Would you like for me to wait?
No.
Okay.
Proceed. Justice is blind. Oh, I can see you. I just can't see anything that's written on my notes. That's all. But if I'm not mistaken, this is, you got 3 points to make the waiver case. I mean, the waiver is the first issue. So if you want to proceed, please do so.
Yes, sir. May it please the court.
Yes.
Molly Odom for Mr. Andino Ortega. There were two issues raised in this case. One has to do with the 16-level crime of violence enhancement, and the other has to do with whether or not the district court abused its discretion because it did not understand it had the authority to vary under acceptance of responsibility. And getting to the crime of violence, the enhancement issue, you have mentioned waiver, and I'm happy to start with that.
Yeah, I think that's the big question here, it seems to me, from the government's case. You know, if there's no waiver, they got problems, perhaps.
All right. Okay.
So please proceed.
Mr. Andino Ortega did not waive the argument. This record reflects that defense counsel did not intentionally abandon a known right. In fact, the record shows just the opposite. At sentencing, during mitigation arguments, defense counsel discussed the 16-level crime of violence enhancement, saying he initially thought that Mr. Andino Ortega would be awarded a 4-level enhancement. And then he says, and I'm quoting here at R101, however, there is case law, particularly I'm looking at Perez-Munoz versus, I believe it's Keisler or Keisler, which finds that if the injury to a child stems from an intentional act, then it definitely is a crime of violence. Counsel has clearly misstated the law. That is not what Perez-Munoz held. This is the antithesis of a waiver. The record shows that counsel not only did not understand the law, but that he would have objected to the enhancement if he had understood the law. And that's the argument that we're making. It is not, he did not know of the issue and consciously chose to forego it.
Ms. Odom, I think the worst case against you is Fernandez-Cusco. Would you just address that, please?
Yes.
I mean, you got a lot of cases for you, but that's the one that you need to address.
Yes. Fernandez-Cusco, which is Judge Barksdale's opinion, in that case, it was discussed whether or not counsel arguably, after they addressed, waived the issue, then there was a discussion on invited error. And in that case, counsel was discussing when he had objected, was requesting a downward departure for overrepresentation. He specifically conceded to the serious nature of the prior offense, but claimed such a serious that was already included in the 16-level enhancement and was asking for a downward variance. The court did not find waiver in that case, and it also did not, what it said was it was arguably invited error. I think what's distinguishable in this case is, again, looking at invited error, that would have to be counsel would have induced the error. And here he is talking about it after the guideline range has already been settled. He is talking about it during mitigation. And what he is saying is that when he's addressing the mitigation aspect, he's making the arguments that the harshness of the sentencing range is too high, and he's asking for a variance. In other words, the issue of whether or not that 16-level enhancement applies has already been settled, and he's discussing it in terms of a variance. Now, I do know that in Fernandez-Cusco, he was also talking about it in terms of a downward variance. But here, in this case, you have counsel clearly misstating the law, and in Fernandez-Cusco, the court went on and addressed it under plain error review, and I think that the court should do that in this case as well. I think the six circumstances are similar.
Great.
Okay.
We'll ask Ms. Sack about that.
All right. I think that this is more similar to an unpublished opinion in Aguilar Delgado, in which counsel did concede that there was an aggravated battery and there was a 16-level enhancement. And this court also said that was not invited error. The concession was not the same as the plain error. He didn't waive the legal claim that was raised on appeal. And that's what we have here, which is a plain error claim. In this case, Under plain error review, the error was clear and obvious under current law. It's also not subject to reasonable debate. This court held in 2002 in Gracia Cantu, a case directly on point and addressing this very statute, that the offense does not have as an element the use of force. This was affirmed in Calderon-Pena when the en banc court was addressing a similar statute, Texas endangerment of a child. Statute is set up the same way and confirmed that it did not have as an element the use of force. And it was affirmed again in Perez-Munoz, the case that counsel misstated during the sentencing hearing in this case, where he misstated the law. In Gracia Cantu, the court addressed the has as an element under 16A. It also found that the statute injury to a child qualifies as a crime of violence because did not qualify as a crime of violence because there was not a substantial risk that force would be used. And that's because the offense can be committed by omission. In Perez-Munoz, the panel was looking at that 16B crime of violence definition and considering it when the indictment shows that the offense was committed by an act. The parties agree in this case, this offense was committed by an act. That, however, does not mean that it has the element, the use of force. And Perez-Munoz expressly says that in it. It starts its analysis by saying we are addressing only 16B. And it then says in its case that the offense can be committed without the use of physical force. That's from Perez-Munoz. So that element under 201.2, which is the only way you get the 16-level enhancement, was not altered by Perez-Munoz. And the government has not shown that this is subject to reasonable debate. They have not shown that Perez-Munoz overruled Gracia Cantu. They have not shown that Mr. Andino would have qualified for the 16-level enhancement under 201.2. They have not shown that he would have qualified for the 8-level enhancement.
Well, we'd have to send that back for that, wouldn't we?
Yes, sir. Under this case law, he qualifies for the 4-level enhancement. He doesn't qualify for the 8-level enhancement because his aggravated felony, his sentence was not over a year.
But the court didn't reach any of those.
No, sir. The court proceeded.
We'd have to send that back and let the court do whatever it is.
But the sentence is over a year. It's plain under this PSC.
Oh, I understand.
Yes, sir.
What about the government's, and I know you respond in your reply brief, but state your position again about why you think this visiting judge, Hood, didn't impose an alternate sentence.
An alternate sentence. There were various mitigation arguments that were presented by the court, and the court said that he had considered the various arguments and elected to impose a sentence within the guideline range. The court did not say that it would impose this sentence regardless, and it did not impose a higher sentence. So, and I know particularly this court is looking at the third and fourth prong on plain error review in this case, and it's going to look at whether or not it's going to exercise its discretion. And this case meets that. On this record, you do not have the court imposing a higher sentence. You do not have a court stating that it would impose an alternate sentence. It does consider the arguments, and it does say it considered the 3553 factors, but that's for within the guideline sentence. It has not given any indication it would impose a higher sentence if it were incorrect.
If you have the record site there where I recall this record excerpt, we don't have the entire transcript of sentencing, but where he said this is within the guidelines or something, don't take but a second. If you don't have it, that's fine. I'll find it.
I think that was in the record excerpts, if I'm not mistaken. Somebody supplied that, didn't it? Ms. Odom?
Yes, sir. It says...
Because there were two record excerpts that were containing, or two portions of the record that were contained in the record excerpt.
Maybe it's just in the brief where it's cited. That's all right.
You know, I've got it right here, and I'm not being able to flip right to it. I will do it in rebuttal if it's not. It is in our brief. It's in the government's brief. The court says that he says, I've considered all the arguments, counsel, and I think the following sentence would be sufficient but not greater than necessary to comply with the goals of the Sentencing Reform Act. Mm-hmm.
In this, the difference between the two sentences,
yes,
at this error, is what?
He received a 16-month sentence. With a four-level enhancement, his guideline range would be 10 to 16 months. So we're talking about a difference of 50 months, 4 years. Mm-hmm. And I do believe that even looking at recent cases such as John, that the court should find that it affected his substantial rights and affected the integrity of the judicial process. John recognized that it is appropriate to vacate the sentence and remand when the sentence is materially or substantially above the properly calculated guideline range. And on this record, he has shown that the error clearly affected his sentence. I also believe that it affects the fairness and integrity would be impugned by allowing a clear mistake of counsel to negate an otherwise glaring mistake under settled law. And that's why I would ask the court to exercise its discretion. In addition, we have a second sentencing issue here. So looking at this case in total, the sentencing hearing, you have an error by the district court as well. When counsel asked for the court to vary because the defendant was not awarded a third point. And I'll get to that in just a minute. I would also like to point out that this is a case from Laredo where the defendant waived his right to appeal. He accepted a higher sentence to appeal. And here we are before this court, yes, on plain error. It should not be before this court, but it is. And I believe the court should exercise its authority, give him his appeal, reverse and remand to address the sentencing issues here. That second sentencing issue has to do with the court's discretion to vary.
Of course, if we remand, we don't need to address that.
Yes, sir, that's correct.
But assuming we did remand, I mean, are you asking us to give any sort of guidance or instructions to the sentencing court on that point?
On the second point?
Yes, ma'am.
I believe Newsom directs that it's up to the court's discretion. And the court should exercise its discretion, understand it has the authority to do so, and decide on its own.
When you say the court, you mean the district court?
Yes, sir,
I'm
resentencing. Sorry. Yes, sir, I should be clear, the district court. Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
Anything else, Ms. Sutton?
Not at this point.
Wonderful. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ms. Sack?
May it please the court, Sherry Zack on behalf of the United States. Your Honors, we believe that Mr. Andino Ortega waived his claim that the prior conviction for Texas felony injury to a child does not qualify for a 16-level enhancement. We believe that there are several reasons for this. First,
now, the lawyer that was representing defendant at the time, was he retained counsel?
No, Your Honor.
He was also with the federal public defender?
That is my understanding, yes. And we believe that he acknowledged that the 16-level enhancement applied, and whether...
Well, do you agree that he properly described Perez-Munez to the district court?
Did he properly describe it to the district court?
Yes, ma'am, because waiver has to be knowing and intelligent. If he misstated the case, then he obviously didn't know what he was talking about, and if he didn't know what he was talking about, it wasn't a waiver.
I believe that his interpretation of the case led him to believe that the 16-level enhancement applied.
Was his interpretation correct?
Potentially no, in that Perez-Munoz was an immigration case. It dealt with an immigration court. It did not deal with a district court at sentencing. However, it is clear that defense counsel knew that if the 16-level enhancement didn't apply, that the four-level enhancement would apply. And he stated to this court that because he believed that it should be in the 21 to 27-month range, which is the four-level range, not the 51 to 63-month range, he demonstrated that he understood that he could make this objection. And he further said, we're not using Perez-Munoz to suggest that it's not a crime of violence. What we're asking this court for is a variance. And so he had ample opportunity to develop his argument. He had ample
Whether he had 23 years to develop his argument has nothing to do with waiver. It's got to be a knowing and intelligent act. I've noticed lately the government's a lot more aggressive about this waiver and invited error. This is the new front, I guess. But I just think you have a real difficult situation in this instance.
If he's incorrect, then he potentially forfeited that right.
Well, of course he forfeited, but that's plain error review. There's no question about that.
If we get to that, I believe that our position is that the record clearly indicates that the district court would have given this sentence regardless of what the guideline range was.
Well, why does the government say, we don't have the full transcript, but it's your brief at 30 where you quote what the court said. He said, I've considered all the arguments of counsel, and I think the following sentence will be sufficient but not greater than necessary to comply with the goals of the Sentencing Reform Act. And when I read that, I thought, well, this isn't an alternate sentence.
Your Honor, if the court had read further in the record at 106, the judge goes on to say that the following sentence is sufficient to deter that kind of conduct for Mr. Ortega coming back into the country and engaging in such conduct in the future, which leads the government to believe that the court was addressing.
Well, I assure you, I did read that part of your brief, and that to me is not an alternate sentence.
Well, the court is addressing the 3553 factors, and according to Delgado Martinez and Bonilla, this court has stated that if the district court committed a significant procedural error as defined by Gall, the court will remand unless the proponent of the sentence establishes that the error did not affect the district court's selection of the sentence imposed. And we look at the district court's selection of the sentence imposed, then we also have to consider United States versus Davis, where this court said that remand is appropriate unless on the record as a whole that the error was harmless and that the error did not affect the district court's selection of the sentence. In this particular case, this district court contemplated different appropriate sentences. This court contemplated the 21 to 27 month range when discussing the prior injury to a child. The court went on to say specifically that if the injury had been worse, because there was an error where the court misspoke about it being a chainsaw as opposed to a weed whacker, that if we had been in that situation, there would be an upward departure. The court clearly recognized that it had the opportunity to impose whatever sentence it chose, whether it was going to call it a variance or not. I mean, I guess this comes down to whether or not there has to be the magic words, this would be the sentence I would impose regardless
It pretty much almost has to be that.
Then,
but you know, on remand, if we send it back, I don't know if it'll go back to Judge Hood, but the judge on remand has that option, I suppose.
Judge Hood considered the 3553 factors, took into account the defendant's immigration status, took into account everything that was said in paragraph 56 of the PSR, which discussed the defendant's prior history of violence, the fact that it's been less than two years since the defendant came back into this country, that there needed to be a deterrent to keep the defendant, A, from coming back again, B, from violating his wife, and C, from violating his children. There were multiple discussions and many different factual colloquies back and forth between defense counsel and the court that show that the court considered all of the 3553 factors and crafted this sentence based on the defendant's actions and the facts in the record, not based on the sentencing guidelines.
Ms. Zak, first of all, I think, you know, let's get down to I think the three cases on the waiver, first of all, that I'd like to discuss with you, and that is Arviso Mata, mm-hmm. Castaneda Baltazar, and then that Fernandez Cusco. And the first two clearly hold that there is no waiver, and the last one says there's an arguable waiver, and all three apply plain error. I mean, does the government contend that we shouldn't review this case under plain error?
Only if Your Honor finds that there was a waiver.
Wonderful. Now, tell me what case that you have that somehow overrules these other cases that it seems to me are on point.
I agree that they're on point, but I believe that in RV Somata, the situation was different. There, they made an objection to the 16-level enhancement, but did not bring up another objection that had to do with the computation of his criminal history based on prior immigration situations. Mm-hmm. And the way that the court crafted the opinion in RV Somata says that counsel knew of the guideline issue and consciously chose to forego it. Well, here, counsel knew of the guideline issue. And the question becomes, is his being wrong a consciously foregoing? I mean, he brought it up. He said, this is a crime of violence, but if it wasn't, it would be at the four-level enhancement, and went on to ask for a variance based on the facts and circumstances of his client's situation.
Great.
And
yeah.
In Martinez, this court stated back in 1992 that failure to advance a meaningful argument, to advance a legal argument constitutes waiver only if the party has a meaningful opportunity. How much more meaningful opportunity should be afforded to defense counsel when, regardless of how much he looked or researched, he came to the opinion that his client, that this was applicable to his client? I can't go back and change his mind about the argument that he's going to put forward strategically. This was his choice. He chose to ask for
a variance.
He used
the words. There's no doubt about it. The question is, how do you characterize that? Is this a legal waiver or not? And, I mean, it seems to me that that's the issue that is before us, and whether or not in this particular case there was or was not.
But don't you agree that if he's wrong in his legal analysis as expressed to the court, it cannot be waiver?
No, Your Honor. Because there, in U.S. versus Martinez, the defense counsel failed to object to the court denying them.
If he can be wrong, and therefore it's waiver, how is it knowing and intelligent?
Because if counsel chooses not to make a closing argument, makes that strategic decision not to make a closing argument, that's a meaningful.
We're talking about counsel interpreting a case. Otherwise, we could just have incompetent counsel and find waiver all day long.
But
incompetent. And, you know, if we found waiver here, then 2 years from now, we're looking at a 2255 ineffective assistance of counsel.
I would suggest that his waiver was not based on incompetence. It was based on a strategy to suggest to the court that, yes, my client did these bad things, but they're not as bad as they sound, that he is remorseful, that he is not planning on doing these things again, and we would ask the court to vary and look at what it would be under a level 4 enhancement. I don't believe defense counsel was incompetent, and I'm not suggesting that to the court. I believe that his strategy was to ask this court, based on the facts and circumstances of his client's situation.
I'm not suggesting that defense counsel in this case is incompetent. I was just stating the hypothetical that we could, you know, we would just find waiver all day long if we had incompetent counsel misstating the law to the sentencing court, and we'd say, well, waiver, you relied on this case even though you didn't know what on earth you were talking about, but waiver.
Well, if it's not waiver, Your Honor, the fact that counsel misstated the law, and this is not suggesting that he's incompetent, it goes to the plain error review. This isn't a clear and obvious error. Counsel got it wrong. They did a great deal of research, as evidenced by the record, before appearing before the court at sentencing. The 22.04 has not been addressed under the 2007 guidelines definition of crime of violence. And so while it may have been crime of violence may have been addressed under similar statutes. That statute has not been addressed by this court. So there is no plain error. And therefore, I believe that the court's, the district court's justification for this sentence supports that this sentence would have been imposed regardless of the guideline.
So you're saying that Calderon-Pena would not require us to hold plain error? That the rationale, although different, but very, very similar, that the rationale in that case does not apply to any holding in this case, that this is or is not a crime of violence?
I don't think we have to get to whether or not it's a crime of
violence.
Assume
we do get to that. Okay, let's assume that.
I mean, assuming we get to that, I still believe that even if the answer is that it was not a crime of violence, that the way the court, in this case, the district court, discussed the facts and circumstances, it's clear from the entire record that this would have been the sentence regardless.
Thank you.
As to the additional issue raised by the defendant, that about the third point of acceptance of responsibility, it's the government's position that they failed to demonstrate that the district court refused to consider a variance. First and foremost, I don't believe a district court sitting anywhere in the United States post-Booker that doesn't know that they have the right to vary at any time. And I think that this situation isn't that they didn't know they could vary. It was they chose not to. Judge Hood said, I'm not going to get involved in the government's decision.
But he never said that he didn't have the authority to vary. Judge Hood went all around the issue, never addressed the real issue that was in front of us or was in front of him.
Judge
Hood, he never mentioned variance, did he? He kind of said, well, I know how did I get to be an old judge and blah, 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 blah.
It was probably not the most articulate.
Let me just say, Judge Hood's been on the bench for a long time in Kentucky. He knows what he's doing.
Absolutely, and that was my point, is that he absolutely knew what he was doing, and just because he said, I'm not going to change what the government's position is, doesn't mean that he didn't believe he couldn't.
And he is from a different circuit that came down here, and it was helping, you may be right, you may be wrong.
I mean, I believe that if you look at the record as a whole, it clearly demonstrates that he knows he can vary. And while the particular back and forth about that specific issue, there are no magic words there saying, you know, you're right, defense counsel, I could vary, but I'm choosing not to. That was not said.
But that would have been the obvious thing to say.
Absolutely. And it probably...
If he thought that that was the law of our circuit.
But I believe he understood that Newsom was the law, and that just because they didn't like that the government didn't grant that third level doesn't mean that they can now claim the judge didn't know what he was doing and isn't familiar with this. I mean, it's like saying, well, I don't like your answer, so you're going to have to change it.
You may be right. You may be wrong.
The point being, it's replete throughout this record that that Judge Hood knew that he could vary. And maybe we are moving towards a situation where every district court judge is going to have to put certain magic words in their sentencings in order to avoid this particular type of argument that we're here before the court today.
I'm not sure you need magic words, but you surely do have to communicate the knowledge that that's a possibility. The question, I mean, in my view, you know, I think he mentioned that case, the Newsom case. Did he not?
Yes. Both defense counsel mentioned it and the court. They both recognized the authority of the government to deny the third level.
But his articulation of why he wasn't doing it, in my view, skirted the issue.
Well, I believe what he was saying was, I'm not going to go back to the appellate court and tell the appellate court that they don't have the right to tell the government, hey, you can give this point if you want. You don't have to. It's clearly the government's call. It's not that I don't believe that conversation.
But that doesn't answer the question here. You're absolutely right. But the question is, notwithstanding what you just finished saying, could he have still given him a one-point variance?
Absolutely.
And he could have, but he never answered that question specifically.
Right, but he says that the government has the right to do what they did, which I think recognizes that he...
You know, I tell my law clerks never argue with me, but always feel free to argue the law with me. And I think we're past, we're not arguing the law anymore. It seems to me, and so, you know, obviously we may have difference of opinion.
I agree, Your Honor, that we do have a difference of opinion about what the district court said, but I believe that his acts under Newsom do not change the overall record, and the overall record supports that the court was conscious of their ability to impose an alternate sentence in this particular case. Mm-hmm. And I believe that they did, even though that's not what they called it. And I think that when you look towards the end of the record at the statements concerning why the court is not downward departing, and the court discusses it in several different places, discusses it when you talk about the immigration issue, when defense counsel brings up how long his client may end up being held after his sentence is over before being deported and asks for a variance because of that. When he asks for a variance because the injury to a child he believes, while egregious, was in the past and that his client understands and can't do this, won't do this again. And further, the court considers a variance when the court misspeaks about the weed whacker chainsaw. And earlier, there is another reference in the record where the court indicates, if I was going to upward depart, I would have told you that ahead of time, which leads the government to believe that the court understood the parameters of the case law and of the current state of that case law, that while an alternate sentence can be imposed, and we believe he did, that the variance in this case fell within what would have been the sentencing guidelines had the 16-level enhancement applied. But if it didn't, if we were still working under the 4-level, which is the 21 to 27 months, it's very clear from this record that the 60-month sentence would be appropriate given the facts that support it, the injuries, the domestic violence, the return within 2 years. And I believe if we take the record as a whole, the court, if the court does not find that there was waiver, but that the claim was forfeited, then there is no plain error. And if there is any error, it's harmless and allow this particular sentence to stand. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Odom? How about this last point, that the record reflects the crime of violence in this case?
The last point, that the record reflects the crime of violence in this case?
Yes.
Are you talking about where the court said that it if it was going to upward depart, it
yes.
That was in reference to counsel was objecting to probation's suggestion that an upward departure may be appropriate in this case, and asking that not be in the PSR. It has effects with regards to the institution, and the court said, if I was going to upward depart, I would let you know. The court does discuss, defense counsel listed a number of reasons for a variance, but the court in its discussion, in declining to vary, gave a within-the-guideline sentence and listed the 3553 factors that it believed were appropriate for that sentence. It was not listing the 3553 factors in terms of this is an upward variance or an upward departure. It was addressing a within-guideline sentence. There was a waiver in this case. There was no waiver in this case. It was plain error. It was clear and obvious. clear and obvious is when it is under this court's current law, and this was under this court's current law. The court has held that if there has been a ruling on the has as an element, section 16A, that applies to 201.2. This offense, injury to a child, 2204, was specifically addressed by this court. It is clear and obvious under current law.
If this were sent back for resentencing, I suppose it would not go back to Judge Hood. I mean, if he was a visiting judge, I suppose a new judge would be assigned to this.
I would think so, yes, sir.
And they do have the new judges in place now, don't they?
Yes, yes, I believe so. Mm-hmm. They do. It would we would start with the correct guideline range, and then the court could exercise its discretion. If the court were to decide to double the offense, we're still looking at a couple of years less than the 60 months that was imposed. If the court were to decide to triple it, we're still looking at over a year less than it was imposed. This should be for the district court to exercise its discretion and determine the appropriate sentence if the court is going to go outside of the guideline range. And in answer to the question about whether or not counsel was saying that, yes, this is a 16-level enhancement, yes, this qualifies for a crime of violence, this case reminds me of Seal, where the defense counsel argued that the suppression issue was based on pre-Miranda because the arrest occurred pre-Miranda. Well, if you read the next sentence in the opinion, in the Supreme Court opinion, Miranda applies retroactively if the trial occurred post-arrest. And that's what happened here. They don't read the next sentence. I mean, I don't know what they were thinking, but it's like, yes, it qualifies for a crime of violence. Under 16B for an aggravated felony, it's clear, it's obvious. Why it happened, I don't know. It's a serious, serious error. And yes, it was our office. But on this record, the court should exercise its discretion. Davis, the case that counsel was referring to that was decided April 2nd, where the court did not reverse and remand. In that case, the district court imposed a sentence above the guideline range in the case below. Here it was within, and the court did not impose an alternate sentence. Check my notes here. Also, with regards to it was strategic, I think the Seventh Circuit addressed this quite well. It said, we cannot conceive of any strategic reason for defense counsel not to object to an increased offense level under 201.2, and the government has not shown why an attorney would bypass an opportunity to object to it. There is just simply no strategic reason. And again, that's from a Seventh Circuit case, but I think it's directly on point. This is not an issue of sandbagging, which the court has had concern with in cases such as Puckett. That's not the case here. It is a clear mistake. Martinez, the case that the government points out, is a pre-Ilano case, where the Supreme Court was, in post-Ilano, the Supreme Court addressed the issue of whether not objecting is waiver versus plain error. And I believe that this is a plain error case.
Thank you, Ms. Odom.
Thank you,
Ms. Zach. Your case is under submission. Thank you. Next case.